Welcome to episode 15 of Transform Together, the Holisticon podcast meetup. I'm Johannes Schartau, and today I'm talking to Joshua Arnold. I first came across Joshua's work in 2014 when I attended one of his sessions at Lean Kanban Central Europe. He spoke about cost of delay, and the ideas from that session have stuck with me ever since. In fact, just this week I used a lot of those ideas in a workshop with a client. Joshua is the Chief Product Officer at Gallagher Security, and on his website Black Swan Farming, he writes about topics like cost of delay, product development, and how organizations can make better decisions about value. Joshua, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Johannes. Good to be here.
So since I was first introduced to you through this topic of cost of delay, it would be great to get started with that. So my first question is, can you explain the topic of cost of delay briefly to the people who might not be familiar with it? What is it and why does it matter?
Sure. So there's a little bit of a head fake in it, and that it's not actually about cost at all. But the short version of it would be that cost of delay is the impact of time on the outcomes that you're hoping to achieve, the benefits that you're hoping to achieve from the things that you're working on. So there is a more formal definition, and that it's the partial derivative of the total expected value over the lifetime of whatever the thing that you're building. And it's the partial derivative of that whole value with respect to time. So how is that value leaking away as you're, if you could have it today, what would that be worth? And if it's a week later or a week after that or so on and so forth, how much of that value is leaking away? What's interesting about it is that it combines two concepts that humans tend to be terrible at distinguishing between. So we have a real tendency to conflate together value and urgency as if they're kind of the same thing. So we treat things that are urgent as if they're really valuable, and we sometimes treat things that are really valuable as if they're urgent, even though they might not be. So the hard part is trying to tease those two concepts apart and treat them separately and then recombine them in a way that helps us make better decisions. So one of the kind of, I guess, the kicker example for me was when we first, I'd done it at a couple of organizations beforehand, but when we did it at Maersk and they allowed us to publish the results of what we found, which became the basis for an experience report that I wrote with a colleague, we surfaced some really interesting examples and sort of plotted the distribution of cost of delay across the whole portfolio. And we sort of, this power law curve sort of popped out with some kind of outlying things that were like, you know, we discovered things that were, you know, $200,000 a week of cost of delay, $200,000 that they were basically giving away for what was actually a pretty small change. The change itself only took about a week to do, but for every week that they didn't do it, they were losing about $200,000 on it. And in particular, what was super funny about that particular example was that they'd actually spent additional time trying to get the estimate really accurate. So they'd put a whole bunch more work into trying to get a really accurate estimate out of it, because of course the system was incentivized for accuracy of estimates. So they basically burned another couple of weeks trying to get a really accurate estimate as opposed to just doing it, which would have gone faster than actually working on a more accurate estimate. So it's kind of a funny little example there that we came across. And I guess the reason why it's, really important is that without some sense of the cost of delay, that of the economic value of the things how their value is leaking away over time, without that bit of information, without that bit of data, the whole product development system ends up optimizing for other things, whether it's accuracy of estimates or, you know, on time, on budget, or, you know, the usual suspects that you see out there, or it'll optimize for, you know, keeping people happy or those sorts of things, as opposed to, you know, trying to deliver the most value in the shortest amount of time, which is what you'd think they'd be incentivized to do. So yeah, there's a kind of the famous line from Don Reinertsen that I love. He describes cost of delay as the the golden key that unlocks many doors. He describes it having this astonishing power to transform the mindset, how we think about development in an organization. And in my experience, I've really found that to be true as well. That really, I sort of view it these days more as a way of thinking about the problem space and a way of framing it, rather than just, you know, a thing that you do in the process. It changes the way you think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, you just called it the golden key that unlocks things. And I'm personally sold. Why doesn't everyone do this?
Yeah, I mean, it is curious, right? So I think it starts with, I mean, there's lots of different things that kind of drive it. But in general, a lot of organizations are pretty blind to cues. They don't realize that there's all of this waiting that's going on in the systems that they're working in. I mean, they feel the end result of that. Like, things take a long time, but they don't seem to realize that a part of the reason why things take so long is that there's actually a whole bunch of cues that are hidden in our organizations. And so that, one, the cues themselves are, they're blind to those cues, and secondly, they're blind to what those cues are costing them. So that kind of drives a whole bunch of behavior relating to it. I think there's a bunch of other optimizations that are happening. So, you know, you look at the way we do approvals and funding in most organizations, and it tends to optimize for accuracy as opposed to speed. You know, it's very rare you come across an approval or funding process that is optimized for recognizing that every minute you spend or every week that you spend trying to get through some approval or funding process represents a loss of value. But yeah, I'd say one of the other main drivers is that there's a certain level of bravery that's required to come up with those estimates in the first place. Like, it's not, you need to be brave enough to be the first person to say, well, I think this is worth, $5,000 a week to us. It's like, well, that sort of invites a whole bunch of people to attack that number, and that may feel personal to us, especially when a lot of the people in the product development system have been beaten over the head for bad estimates for many, many years. So as soon as you ask them to make an estimate of the value side of the equation, they're like, nah, that ain't happening. I know what's going to happen here. I'm going to get beaten up when I guess wrong. So, So I think as a result, we end up falling back on a whole bunch of qualitative approaches and relative approaches that just don't give you the same level of understanding of the value that's leaking away. It's kind of massively weakens it. And I think the thing that I kind of say to people is that, you know, those decisions don't disappear if you don't quantify the cost of delay. They just get made badly. So, you know, it's actually Don Reinertsen that tells the classic joke of, you know, a couple of dudes out in the wilderness, and they come across a bear, and, you know, so one guy sort of takes off and the other guy stops and starts doing up his shoelaces, and the guy who's running off is like, what are you doing? You can't outrun a bear. Why are you tying up your shoelaces? That's not going to help. You can't outrun the bear. And he turns around and says, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. And the analogy there to product development is that we don't have to be better than, we don't have to be perfect. You know, we don't actually have to outrun the bear. We just have to outrun the thing that we're using, which is the alternative, which is in most cases is just our gut intuition. And our guts aren't a very reliable kind of guide for, again, determining the difference between value and urgency and making better decisions in this world. So yeah, I mean, I always encourage people to at least have a crack at it, even if they don't necessarily share the number with anyone else, if you're not feeling strong enough to do that. But there's still a value in adopting a mindset around it so that you've got a bit of an understanding around that. The other thing you can do is that you can kind of, one thing I would recommend is go and find your friendly finance person who's usually got their fingers on all the numbers. They know exactly what all these numbers are. And they love building a spreadsheet. You know, who doesn't, who, find me a finance person that doesn't love a little spreadsheet. And before you know it, they will build you a little cost of delay model according to whatever it is that you're looking at. So you can generally find people in the organization who are willing to make those brave guesstimates and put some numbers together. And then once you put that number out there, yeah, people can, oh no, that's wrong. Oh, really? Well, what do you have that tells us it's wrong? Do you have some better data? Happy days. Let's share that, you know, like... Oh, we use the wrong number for what the employee cost is and FTE cost is. Sweet. Tell me what the right number should be. Or, the cost of customer acquisition. Oh, no, that's not the right number for cost of customer acquisition. Okay, well, what is it then? Tell us what it is. What are your assumptions? So, yeah, I think there's things that people can do, but I'd say more than anything, give it a crack.
Yeah, that's what you just mentioned is also my experience, that once you make these assumptions visible, it really transforms the entire conversation and it becomes much more of a joint discussion about what do we believe, what can we see. And then, like you're saying, if someone is brave enough to take the first stab at it, then it kind of, you know, triggers that whole conversation that invites other people.
Yeah,
and is really useful. I invite people on this podcast for also self-help for myself, I guess. Here's one of my experiences that often people really understand the general concept and say, yeah, that's great. We should start quantifying cost of delay. It absolutely makes sense. Then they start building maybe like the first list and they start working with that concept, and then at some point later in the process there's this dynamic that happens that someone will come in and says, yeah, that's a great list, it totally makes sense, at the same time the CEO asked for this and he wants these five things done by next week, so we have to kind of push that in there. And what's your response to this? Why do we see this happen? What is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen that myself, so no surprise. In fact, I've, talked and written about this for many years. So the classic highest paid person's opinion, the hippo comes in and basically squashes everyone and says, yeah, all good and well, this is what we're going to do. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the nature of human organizations is, rightly or wrongly, a hierarchy tends to emerge. Even when it's not formal, there'll always be some sort of hierarchy. When you don't have that that language around value and urgency, then it tends to default to authority and politics, and you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and quid pro quo sort of setups. So I'm well familiar with those. I think you don't have to win all of the battles necessarily. You can kind of like, it's okay to have, to allow the system to be how the system is, but still to chip away at it and try to set in place the structure that will help to inform better decisions. And one thing that I have actually done prior is when, the highest paid person, the CEO or whoever, swoops in and insists that, no, this is the one thing, then I literally will take, okay, well, this was our previous highest cost of delay on CD3 sort of thing, therefore this one must be higher than that, so let's just give it a nominal value of that, and then let's see how people react to that. So I'll almost turn the hippo insistent that this is the highest value and highest value, highest urgency thing for us to do, and I'll flip it into a an assumed cost of delay. Now, if it turns out that that's not accurate, then at least you can always point back and say, well, that was the CEO who said it was that, so we ran with it, So, yeah, you don't have to win them all, I think. I think you can still, try to get to that sorted list, use CD3 to basically get to a sorted list by duration. It still drives a lot of the right behaviors in terms of thinking about the cost of queues. It drives the right behaviors around understanding that, if you take the the 20% that you can find within a bigger chunk that is worth 80% of the value, then you know it's way higher in value. So a lot of the gamification that happens, even in systems that tend to be highly political, you can still get some of the right behaviors to sort of emerge. So I think, the more you can kind of make those cost of delay numbers visible, I'd say that's probably the bit that will help to drive the change. But yeah, you don't have to, I guess, like I said at the beginning, you don't have to win all of the battles. You can still allow humans to be human. Unfortunately, when none of us are perfect, no organization is perfect. I don't, even at Maersk, where we ran this, there were still adjustments that we would make. That's okay. It's not like it's, I don't think we're wedded to the number. You don't treat it like a GPS signal that when it says drive off the cliff, you just blindly drive off the cliff. No, you are allowed to make human decisions around it. No framework is perfect. So, and sometimes the model itself is just lacking the nuance of some sense of actually that other thing over there is more valuable, but I can't quite articulate it. That's okay.
So other than this, when people start using cost of delay, what can they expect to go wrong in the beginning, or where do teams, organizations struggle with when they just start out using this concept?
Yeah, I'd say the first mistake that people tend to make is that they think it's about the cost of delay is really just the burn rate of the team. They think that's the cost. And it's like, no, it's actually the value side of the equation. It's not the cost side of the equation. So just being clear about that, it's actually more about the benefits, not to worry too much about the costs. But I'd say, the number one thing I'd say that people, if they test it and they have an allergic reaction to it, it's probably because they've gotten stuck on precision as opposed to being directionally accurate. Like in all of the work that we've done, that I've done in multiple organizations, we're talking orders of magnitude difference from the top end of it down to the long tail of stuff that's towards the bottom. So you only need to be within order of magnitude to still be more accurate than your gut intuition. So don't worry too much about getting to a precise number. Certainly if you're using discounting and all of that kind of net present value stuff, like that's a level of precision that I don't think any of us really have around the benefit side of the equation. If we think we're bad at doing estimates on the how long things take, well, the lack of accuracy or precision on the benefit side of the equation is way, way higher. And then the other thing I'd say related to that is that, like, again, our teams are expensive to run. They're not cheap, right? So, and we're not looking for like a benefit cost ratio that's just barely above one. We're looking for kind of like, actually for a month of this team's time, we really need to be generating something like 10 times that value in terms of the outputs. So if it's 10 or 9 or 11, like, doesn't matter. Those are still big numbers compared to the cost of the team. So you're in the right ballpark is sort of what I'd guide people to be a bit more focused on. And then I think the other little tweak I would tend to make about how people do this is that they tend to think in really big chunks. So they think about the benefits in terms of a whole year. And there's something magical that happens when you just slice the time, slice down to a week or a month or maybe a quarter at the outside, because that drives a different behavior than if you're doing it at annual or, 5 year sort of level. So I always try to articulate the cost of delay as a per week or a per month sort of number, because then I can do some mental maths with funnels around, is it worth us bringing on, finding this different path here that it will cost another $5,000 to do it that way, but the cost of delay is $25,000 a month. So Yeah, I do that every day of the week, you know. So, yeah, I'd say, yeah, there's lots you can sort of then use it for. It's not just for prioritization. It's not just about understanding the benefits. It then becomes a way of seeing all of the things that are going on. So you don't need those to be super accurate. And I'd say a smaller time slice means that it becomes a more useful key to unlock lots of doors, as Don Henderson puts it. So.
Yeah, we're already kind of transitioning into the next topic. I started out in the Agile space, and what I noticed at some point was that this whole idea of projects was kind of always causing issues for me in my workplace. Oh. And then I noticed that on your website, you were sharing content and you were very clear about the topic that you believe using projects as the default model for delivering value is problematic. Can we get into that? So why do you say that?
Yeah, I mean, how long have you got? It's so, the way it shows up is so funny. And yeah, I think we've come a long way, like massive kudos to, you know, the team who sort of famously didn't agree on much, but they agreed at least on the manifesto. And I think really pushed the whole software world quite a long way towards where we need to go. But I think, you know, moving away from the old software is like an infrastructure project, and therefore you plan the whole thing out in inordinate detail as if we pour on concrete, and you've got to get all of the details right up front. So that classic old waterfall process, thankfully a lot of that is gone now. So I think most organizations understand that the way you do software is different. I'm not sure if they really understand why, but they know that that's the accepted norm now to not do it that way. Yeah, I still think they have struggled with the why, but the one bit that hasn't really changed is the funding model is still stuck in project land. You know, and even, you know, the organization that I'm at the moment, you know, still thinks in projects for some of the things that it does. So trying to tease them out of that model and start to think of more of a continuous flow of changes sliced and diced into small enough so that we can tighten feedback loops, iterate on it when we need to, all that good stuff. So yeah, I think that kind of the old PMI definition of this kind of a temporary team with a fixed scope, a specific set of resources, a lot of that's already been dealt with. So we've got modern teams that tend to be stable, long-lived teams. They don't really have an end date on them anymore. So I think the traditional definition of project is already well broken, but there's still bits of it that, you know, the finance team still tends to think of things and projects. And mostly that's just because it's a funding model that they can wrap their head around. There's a whole game that goes on around CapEx and OpEx. If you're capitalizing any of the work that you're doing, there's certainly ways to do that doesn't require a project bucket that you do it within. But yeah, I think I would say the language matters. Like the, you know, project implies this sort of beginning, middle, end, as opposed to the product sort of way of thinking about it, which is really just a continuous flow of learning and delivery. So yeah, I feel like the world has come a long way, so I don't have to fight that battle so much anymore. But there's still aspects of software and product development world that are still a bit stuck in that mindset. But yeah, thankfully it's improved.
What I find fascinating is when I talk to people about this, they have this really visceral reaction of, "But we cannot stop funding or, you know, budgeting," and could you briefly outline in your ideal world what is the alternative? What do you offer people? What does it look like if you let go of that annual budgeting cycle, for example?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that we had to crack at Maersk in order for us to get to where we wanted to go. It was probably one of the key unlocks for the work that we did, amongst, you know, other bits and pieces that we did. But we basically gave them options. We were like, So yeah, we really want to move away from projects. We would like to move to more of a continuous funding model. And we gave them some options. We were like, look, you could either fund for a fixed length of time, where you could fund a buffer of changes. So we'll bring you 10 or 20 at a time and you fund that group. We may change the order that we do them in, but at least we'll know we've got a continuous funding round. Or the alternative would be, as each one comes in, you fund them just in time. And the funny thing is, when you sit down and run through those options with them, they're like, ah, okay, well, actually, if you break down the projects to, you know, an epic or a user story, you know, or a feature level, all of a sudden the level of investment is so small, none of the overhead is justified. So they're kind of like, well, we'll just do a quarterly funding thing, was how it basically ended up. So they would basically just look at it and go, we'll just continuously fund you every quarter on quarter. And this was a big shift for Merce. They came from a very heavy project governance model with a centralized PMO. Like, it wasn't easy to unpick it. The key was to go and make friends with the finance team and get them on board with what we were trying to do. A big part of what changed their mind was us showing them the feast and famine that the project funding drove. So basically, they would have no money, so they basically were just trying to survive doing bits and pieces that they could until the next project was funded. And then they had all of this money, and they became this massive magnet for a whole bunch of changes to come through. So, of course, the project got bigger. Typical stuff, right? Like, seen it so many times, it's hilarious. So sort of showing them that feast and famine and the impact it was having on the teams versus, if you give us this continuous funding model, we won't have this feast and famine problem. We can just have this nice smooth flow and everything can work a bit better. And again, that was part of showing them the cues that were building up. And then obviously this feast famine as those cues were flushed through. So, I could talk about how that sort of worked, but I'd say the first sensible step there is really to go and talk to your finance folks, help them understand the problem that you're trying to solve, why it matters, and propose some alternatives and see what they go for.
You recently started talking about a concept called product DevOps. What do you mean by that? And what is missing if an organization has maybe like good DevOps, but not really established product thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive kudos to the folks that popularized DevOps, because I think they really helped to solve a problem that Scrum had sort of come some way, like by forcing us to try to do an iteration of the product every 2 weeks, that drove a level of continuous integration, continuous delivery-ish, you know, on like a 2 week, maybe 3 week originally, down to 2 week sort of horizon. And then the whole DevOps thing was just squishing that until it was just like daily or hourly or, you know, 10 times a day sort of thing. That's been a massive unlock in terms of like your ability to move, and the flow through the system is so much better. But of course, you can always flow shit through the pipe. It doesn't need to be, you know, there's no rule that says your continuous delivery pipeline has to be full of gold. It could equally be full of crap, you know? So what I'm tried to articulate with a shift to sort of product DevOps was more like, fast and safely is really important, but we need to make sure we're coupling to that a focus on finding the right things for us to deliver and to learn quickly in doing it. So without that learning, you're basically dead. You're just shipping rubbish and no idea whether it's actually working for the end user or not. So that feedback loop is missing, and then choosing your ability to choose the and slice the things that are coming, the opportunities in front of you, that's a key part of the whole product development puzzle, I think. So DevOps on its own is an important ingredient, but it's not the whole thing. Yeah, so that's sort of the way I guess I don't know what more I can say about that.
How do you figure that AI kind of plays into all of this? How can it help us? Do you think it's just about, because what I see at the moment, people really look at the efficiency side or just creating more output. Could it also, for example, help us quantify cost of delay better, or what else can it do for us?
Yeah, I mean, early days, right? So we're really still learning what's possible. But I'm old enough now to sort of have seen a few of these waves of new hotness come through. So, you know, we've had the agile way, we've had the lean way, we've had the design thinking way, we've had the cloud way, we've had the DevOps way, the product itself, you know. So, and I think each of those promised to change everything. And in some ways, each of them did change everything. But with each wave, there's still an underlying question that still needs to be answered about whether we're actually making meaningful progress, however you choose to define that. So I don't think there's any particular magic there with the use of generative AI. What I have noticed is that, you know, generative AI and all of these wonderful new tools, they don't fix the dysfunction. They tend to amplify the dysfunction. So it basically puts your blind spots, your habits, your habits that you had before, it's just put all of that on steroids. And so you need to be even better at selecting what is the most valuable thing to go after, because all of a sudden the speed at which you can go after one of those things is so much higher. I feel like, a lot of the false friends out there are just as dangerous as they ever were. And what I'm really heartened by is, Kent Beck gifted us some amazing truths in XP. And a lot of what I would consider to be the goodness in the agile wave is really rooted in a lot of what Kent Beck kind of put forward all those years ago. But I find it amusing that in 2026, the way to succeed with your AI genies beside you, helping you do the stuff, are the exact same things that we were talking about way back in 2001. Like, here we are basically 25 years later, and it's a lot of the same skill sets. It's the fast feedback loops. It's the, you know, being choosy about what you build. It's, you know, unit testing. It's all of those, you know, continuous integration. There's a lot of similarity between what we were trying to implement then and what we need in order to keep these things on the rails now. So, yeah, I think I'm super excited to see where this goes. I mean, I'm using it myself. My teams are, I've got, you know, 200 odd people here in New Zealand, and I'm every second day I have to go and approve another half a dozen. I want to try out this tool. It's like, okay, cool, click, click, click. So people are picking it up and testing and learning and playing with it. To your question, I do think about, you know, how this can help with, you know, quantifying cost of delay. I do think that this will help us ask braver questions. So rather than us having to come up with the cost of delay model and figuring out what it could be and, you know, being brave, we can use the AI to be brave for us, sort of feed it some information about how cost of delay works, and then ask it to, you know, do a rough sizing. I mean, I've done a whole bunch of, as I'm sure you have as well, like you can do a ton of product research into all sorts of things using these toolings. It's just one step away to then just say, okay, give me a cost of delay of that particular thing, and it'll spit out an answer. Now, that's not to say it'll be right. But would it be any less accurate than yours or my guess? Yeah, probably not. Like, ultimately, we're still we're still making an informed estimate. So, I mean, I haven't put a ton of time and energy into. I did try to build a little cost of delay calculator tool probably a year ago now, and then I just got really busy. But I think there are. I haven't got to the point of just adding a new skill, which is, you know, here's a skill which is calculating cost of delay and just adding that to my Claude code kind of setup. But yeah, one day I'll probably have a crack at that. So yeah, let's see where it goes. Yeah, I think there's a whole, I'm definitely in the mindset. I mean, I'm hiring right now. I'm out in market, probably hiring another 100 people. So I don't see this as being something that should be considered a threat to, software developers, engineers in general. I do think it's going to blur the lines between who does what and how it happens. And we're definitely going to have smaller, faster moving teams, I think. And there'll be a mix of people and agents doing all sorts of things. Internally, where I am at the moment, we're using it all over the place to speed up outcomes, and in particular, speed up outcomes that we thought were not possible before have all of a sudden become, maybe if we chuck that at an LLM and see what it can make of it, it's actually just discovered a way of doing the thing that we didn't think was possible. Or it will change the calculus around the cost and duration of doing something. So a lot of those modernization projects that just never would have seen the light of day because it was going to be too big and too difficult now become doable. But I also suspect that the future is going to be, there's going to be a lot more software in the future. I mean, just look at how GitHub's, the number of repos that GitHub are juggling has just gone through the roof. So I feel it's a little bit like we've gone from, analog world, wet film, digital, taking photos, the sum total of all of the photos that were ever taken in history was something like 20 million photos or some crazy number like that. We now take, or maybe it was 20 billion, I can't remember. We now take something like 2.5 billion, 2,500 billion per year. So I think software's going to be, but it feels like we're going from analog cameras, wet film cameras to digital cameras. I feel like we're making that same transition, but with software. So there's going to be a Cambrian explosion of what we've got out there. A lot of it will be slot cannon dross for sure. And that's okay if its main reason for existing is to prove out an idea. If you then have proven out that idea and now you need to go and, rewrite it in such a way that it is more scalable and secure and all those sorts of things, happy days. But the cost of testing an idea now has just massive. It's just dropped to almost zero. I mean, I do think the cost of tokens will probably go up at some point, but in the meantime, we can chew through some cheap tokens and test a whole bunch of stuff. So, yeah, I'm pretty. I'm excited about where it's going. I feel like the bottleneck has shifted from how do we get this done to more to, what should we be building? And judgment, good judgment, has become the scarce resource, not the ability to write code. So let's see where that goes.
All right, final question. You already answered part of this, but I was wondering what other transformational challenges do you see for organizations in the future, and what can we do today to prepare for those?
Yeah. A little bit like I was saying before, I feel like there's so much raw truth in some of the principles that have come out of the Agile movement. I still think that the core challenge stays the same. I'm hiring for curiosity, and I'm hiring for a sense of urgency, and I'm hiring for good judgment. And those things aren't really going to change. We're looking for people who have the ability to adapt. So I feel like those capabilities aren't going anywhere. So that's sort of an ultimate truth. And so, those fundamentals don't change. The value, the urgency, the flow, the fast feedback, the small batches, the ability to do distributed decision making, all of that stuff just gets dialed up to 11. So, and then underneath it all, we've got all these awesome new tools, but at the end of it, people are still the multiplier. People are the bits that make the magic happen. I think there's going to be a lot of change, I think, in organizational structures, how that works. If you're still stuck in project world and dealing with, long budgets, I think, get with the program on some of those as soon as possible. The slower, more predictable world model things, those are probably, they're past their use-by date, very, very much so. So, shifting to the new containers of, DevOps and continuous delivery and all of those XP practices, and having funding models and organizational designs that can handle a good mix of people and agents doing interesting things. Those are all going to be valid in the future. And for leaders, I think, you're investing in the team as a capability. And the output is almost, you can throw it away and rewrite it, basically. So we're really more interested in speeding up those feedback loops. Making the cost of delay visible will hopefully get easier as well. So yeah, let's see how that plays out.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time, Joshua.
Not at all. It's good to chat.
As always, this podcast is sponsored by Holisticon. We provide companies with holistic support from strategy to technology to organizational change. And if this sounds interesting, you can find all the information you need at holisticon.de. And don't miss our next Transform Together session on June 9th at 2 p.m. Central European Summer Time. I will be talking to Lily David. She's the co-developer of Sociocracy 3.0, and she will let us know how to change an organization using that approach. See you then.